Penguin Random House Audio presents For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World. This is the author, Sasha Sagan. Introduction. I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion. Albert Einstein. A life without festivity is a long road without an inn. Democritus. When I was little and my dad was alive, he would take me to see the dioramas at the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan. This was a holy place for me, grand and full of answers to deep and ancient questions. It filled me with awe, but it also frightened me. I would hide behind my dad's legs, nervously stealing peeks at the frozen animals. "That one just moved," I would squeal. "No, sweetie, it's your imagination. They can't move," my dad would tell me. "How do you know?" "Because they're dead." This was a foggy and vague concept at the time, foggier even than it is now. I could see the bears and gazelles, but in some larger way, they were not really there. I knew that my dad was deeply committed to accuracy. I knew that he had more information on the topic than I did, so I could probably take him at his word. They were not moving. And yet, my mind played tricks on me. As we continued among the other exhibits, bright, sharp gems, early human and dinosaur skeletons, Neanderthal tools, gold Aztec figurines, Yoruba masquerade costumes, all sacred artifacts in the temple of history and nature, this mystery of death followed me, and I wondered about it a lot. What it meant, what exactly it was, what I was supposed to do with the knowledge of its existence. It's dangerous to believe things just because you want them to be true. That's what my dad told me, very tenderly, not much later. I had asked him why I had never met his parents. He told me that it was because they were dead. "Will you ever see them again?" I asked. The animals in the dioramas were dead, but we could still see them. He told me that he'd like nothing better in the whole wide world than to see his parents again, but he had no evidence to prove he would. No matter how tempting a belief was, my father preferred to know what was true. Not true in his heart, not true to just him, not what rang true or felt true, but what was demonstrably, provably true. "We humans have a tendency to fool ourselves," he said. I thought about the dioramas again. He was right. The animals hadn't been moving, though I could have sworn they were. We discussed the history of the world a lot at home. My parents taught me that there has never been any correlation between how true something was and how fervently it was believed. Sure, some things are subjective. This may be the best sandwich you've ever had, or that may be the most handsome man you've ever seen. Those are in the eye of the beholder. For those phenomena that exist outside of our perceptions, things like the way the earth moves, the causes of illnesses, or the distance between stars, there were objective realities, maybe undiscovered by anyone on our planet, but no less real. People once believed with all of their hearts that the sun went around the earth, but believing it didn't make it so. There are certainly things we believe right now that will someday be revealed to be hilariously or abhorrently ignorant. Our understanding changes with new information, or at least it ought to. So if a person is interested in testing their preconceptions, in discovering how things really are and why, how does one go about that? My parents taught me that the scientific method is designed for precisely this job. My father was a scientist. He was the astronomer and educator Carl Sagan. Science wasn't just his occupation. It was the source of his worldview, his philosophy, his guiding principles. He and my mom, writer and producer Andrianne, taught me that belief requires evidence. They taught me that science wasn't just a set of facts to be compared and contrasted with other philosophies, but a way of testing ideas to see which ones stand up to scrutiny. They taught me that what scientists think today might be disproven tomorrow. And that's wonderful, because that's the pathway to a better, deeper understanding. This left me with something of a conundrum when my dad died. I had just turned 14. I longed to see him again somehow. I would often dream of being reunited with him. In these dreams, I would receive an elaborate explanation about where he'd been. Usually a misunderstanding or some kind of secret mission was to blame. The dreams would all end the same way. Elated, I'd tell him, "I knew it. I knew you weren't really dead. I have these dreams all the time where you come back." And as I'd say those words, a sorrowful look would cross his face, and I would realize, "This is one of those dreams, isn't it?" And he would nod apologetically, and I would awaken. Still now, more than 2 decades later, I sometimes have those dreams. Everything he taught me, everything he stood for, keeps me from believing that I will ever be reunited with him. But our secular home was not cynical. Being alive was presented to me as profoundly beautiful and staggeringly unlikely, a sacred miracle of random chance. My parents taught me that the universe is enormous and we humans are tiny beings who get to live on an out-of-the-way planet for the blink of an eye. And they taught me that, as they once wrote, for small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. That is a line that appears in the novel Contact, the only work of fiction my dad ever published. He and my mom had first envisioned it as a movie, but movies take a very long time to make. This one in particular took about 18 years, from conception to premiere. During those years, my parents decided to try the story out as a novel, which they dedicated to me. As with everything they wrote, Contact was a collaboration. Though that line gets attributed to my dad, his name is on the cover of the book, it's my mom who actually came up with those words, which have served as a perfect crystallization of our family philosophy. Growing up in our home, there was no conflict between science and spirituality. My parents taught me that nature, as revealed by science, was a source of great, stirring pleasure. Logic, evidence, and proof did not detract from the feeling that something was transcendent. Quite the opposite. It was the source of its magnificence. Through their books, essays, and television series, Cosmos, these ideas reached many millions of people around the world. So much of the philosophy contained in this audiobook you're listening to comes from them. My parents taught me that the provable, tangible, verifiable things were sacred, that sometimes the most astonishing ideas are clearly profound. But when they get labeled as facts, we lose sight of their beauty. It doesn't have to be this way. Science is the source of so much insight worthy of ecstatic celebration. We humans are very good celebrators. I dare say we're the best at it in the whole wide world. Other species may express giddy enthusiasm when there's plenty to eat or when it's time to mate. Those events are certainly worthy. We celebrate them too. But other species don't plan parties, they don't prepare feasts, they don't wear special outfits, put up special decorations, or say special words. They hardly even take the day off. We, on the other hand, really get into it. Think of the billions of people who put time and effort into Christmas every year, into Chinese New Year, into Eid al-Fitr. Think of every culture, subculture, and religious sect that prescribes its own detailed procedures for honoring a holy day or a rite of passage. Think of every slight mutation as recipes and prayers are passed down from parent to child. Picture all the preparing, the decorating, the sacrificing, the riches spent over the eons to honor Zeus or Quetzalcoatl. In every inhabited corner of the earth, human beings have created rituals to give order and meaning to existence. There is seemingly endless variety, and yet there are clear and undeniable similarities, too. I am the mother of a beautiful little girl, curious and lively, who regularly leaves me amazed. She is still too young to tell me her philosophy. I don't know what it will be or how she will come to it. as she grows and learns to think for herself, I can only hope to create a framework from which she will find that stirring beauty in
Sample complete. Ready to continue?